Twins fans. This is John Swole with TwinsTrivia.com, and today we get the opportunity to spend some time talking with Mike Cubbage. Mike played with the Rangers, the Twins, and the Mets between 1974 and 1981. After his playing career ended, Mike moved into the manager's role and served in that capacity in the Mets organization for 7 seasons. He next moved up to the New York Mets as a coach in 1990 and 91, and then served as the Mets' interim manager at the end of the 1991 season when Bud Harrelson was let go. After that, Mike Cubbage returned to coaching with the Mets for 5 more seasons, then moved on to coach with the Houston Astros for 5 years, and then moved to the Boston Red Sox, where he coached third base for 2 more seasons. After finishing his coaching career, Mike moved into the scouting role and is serving in that capacity with the Tampa Rays today. So let's get right to it and talk with Mike. Mike, you were born in Charlottesville, Virginia. Is that where you grew up?
Well, yes, for the most part. We traveled around a few years. My dad was working for a construction company out of Washington, D.C. And for instance, back in 1955, when I was 5 years old, we were in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I went to my first major league game at Briggs Stadium that year and became a big Tigers fan and a big Al Kaline fan. And Kaline was winning the American League batting title that year as a 19-year-old. So that was my first exposure to professional, to Major League Baseball. I was already a pretty big fan. But a couple of years later, I went to the first grade in Hyattsville, Maryland, and then my family moved back to Central Virginia, Charlottesville, so I wouldn't have to be going to a different school every year.
Did you play sports in high school?
I did. I played all 3 sports. Like most guys that played the major leagues, a pretty good athlete, and I think most major leaguers probably played basketball and football. And yeah, I love basketball. Football, I played it, and also I played a couple of years in college. But baseball was my true love.
Okay. You attended the University of Virginia. Can you tell us a little bit about your collegiate career?
Well, John, I got the first full baseball scholarship at the University of Virginia. And I tell you what they did. They took a football grant name and X'd out football and typed in baseball above it. So that's where the money came from. But that's my claim to fame there. I played 3 years. Back then, freshmen were allowed to play. I had a really good sophomore year, a pretty good junior year, and I signed after my junior year. I played better in the summer. The weather wasn't real good here in the springtime, and we started so early. And I always thought my best baseball was in the summer leagues, where I played in the Valley League in here in Charlottesville, Virginia. And then my last year as a amateur, as a collegiate, I went out to Pierce, South Dakota, and played out in the old Basin League. So that was a good experience. And I played for Jack Stallings out there, a legendary college coach at Wake Forest and Florida State and Georgia Southern. And I played for a pretty good college coach myself in Virginia, a guy by the name of Jim West, who taught me a lot.
Okay. What positions did you play there?
I was a shortstop in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some really good players on that Basin League club. For instance, Mike Pasek was my roommate, and we ended up playing together in Minnesota. And we also had Mike Caldwell, who went on to be a pretty good major league pitcher. We had Max Gear, Sonny Seyfried, Greg Pryor, played second base on that club with me. We had a pretty good team out there in Pierre.
Okay. Yeah, I remember Mike Caldwell. I think
I pitched a long time. I had some really good years with the Brewers, and I also played with Mike in Charlottesville in the Valley League, and played against him in college. He was at NC State when I was at UVA.
Okay. The Senators drafted you in the 6th round in 1968, but you chose not to sign. Was that an easy decision for you?
It really wasn't, and I was taken in the 5th round. I really wanted to play baseball. And the Senators were a poor franchise and didn't really have a lot of money. And that summer, I gave up my last year of eligibility in the American Legion and played for Jim West, my college coach, in the Valley League against college competition. I had a really good year as a 17-year-old, the only high school kid in the league. I think I led the league in home runs. So I was hoping that the Senators would up their offer, and at the end of the summer I would sign and go play professional baseball. But they weren't all that impressed. I think they raised their offer from $5,000 to $10,000. So I said, thanks, but no thanks, and enrolled at UVA.
I see. And then, you know, then again in 71, the Senators were there and drafted you again, and this time in the second round, I think, and you accepted their offer.
Yeah, I did. They needed players, and I had to give them permission to draft me again, because once a club drafts you and you go unsigned, then I went into the old secondary phase of the draft, mm-hmm. and they have to have permission. But a couple of their scouts really liked me, and Hal Keller was a farm director. I think he liked me, and I knew that. And I knew that they needed players, so I thought it would be maybe a good organization to sign with. Compared to, say, the Cincinnati Reds, who also, like me, were just loaded with major league talent. So I gave them permission, and yeah, I think they upped their offer to about $7,500 or something like that, but I didn't get a great deal of money. I got the incentive bonus plan, which is $7,500, so it wasn't a big package.
Okay, but it was still pretty nice money, though, back then. Still can't complain.
Well, I just wanted the opportunity to play, and I remember the guy that signed me, Joe Branzell, just said, go out and play, and you'll make your money. And I didn't make a lot in the minor league. I think I went to work for $500 a month. I'm not sure what the starting salary of the minor leagues today is.
Mm-hmm.
When I made the big leagues in 1974, I think the minimum salary was $15,000, and I thought that was a lot of money. But I believe the minimum today is close to $400,000.
Yeah, quite a difference. Quite a difference. You started, you played in A-ball in 71 and 72, and then Double-A, I think, in 1973. But in 1974, I believe you made the big league club out of spring training. What were the circumstances of you making the Rangers team?
Well, I did make that club. I had a really good Double-A season in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And I was actually in the hunt for the batting title that year, and it went right down to the last day. Jim Rice won it. I think he had 316 or 317, and Jim had left and moved on to AAA. So I needed a 4-for-4 in the last day of the season. I could have caught Rice. I went 2-for-4 and fell a few points short, but finished, I think, third in the league in hitting, and went to the instructional league, and that's where I met newly named manager Billy Martin.
Ah.
Billy was down there and watched Jim Sundberg and Mike Hargrove and myself play in the instructional league. And after that, they asked me to go to Culiacan, Mexico. So I got a great deal of experience in the offseason playing. Went to spring training the next year as a roster man for the first time. And I think Billy got me 70-some at-bats, which is a really high number of at-bats for a rookie. And I was surprised, but I made the club along with Hargrove and Jim Sundberg.
Those were some good players, too.
Yeah, I think Mike Hargrove was Rookie of the Year, and Jim Sundberg was probably the best defensive catcher I ever played with, and had a long-time career with the Rangers, and is an executive for them now, and a great guy. They got an opportunity to get some playing time early in the year, and I really didn't, so I ended up splitting 1974 and 1975 in Texas and in Spokane, Washington, in AAA of the Pacific Coast League.
Yeah. I think that first season that you were up with Texas, I think you went like 0-for-15. What did you think after that season ended and you hadn't gotten a hit in those at-bats? What were you thinking?
Well, I was a little embarrassed about that, and I was beginning to wonder if I'd ever get that hit. But I tell you about that season, the 0-for-15, it came in three different steps. I was there at the beginning of the year, my first mm-hmm. major league against Raleigh Fingers, a pinch hit, and I think I had five pinch hit at bats when I went down to AAA. Stayed down there a couple of weeks in an emergency situation, and and had, I think I got one start and a couple more pitch at bats. So I was 0 for 5 the second time, and then went back down around Memorial Day and spent the summer in Spokane, came back in September after we won the PCL championship out there, had a really good club, and sat around for 20-some days because the Rangers were in the hunt for the first division and some money. I think we finished second. I got to play the last 2 days in Minnesota and went 0 for 5 and got one start, 0 for 4, hit a few balls hard. But, yeah, I was a little embarrassed that I didn't get a hit that first year.
Yeah, just something that kind of probably played on your mind. But you started the 75 season in the minors but got called up in mid-June and then kind of stayed with the Rangers for the rest of the season. After starting your career, you know, hitless like you did, I believe you got your first big league hit off of Bill Singer in Anaheim, and it was a grand slam home run. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was. It was quite a thrill and also quite a relief to finally get that hit. It was my first start after coming back. I'd gone two more at-bats, the pitch hit at-bats, and was hitless, of course, and I got that first start at second base out there in Anaheim. Singer was on the mound. And I think we were up 2-0, and the bases were loaded, and they hit that home run to put us up 6-0, and ended up getting 3 hits that night. So, yeah, the weight of the world was off my shoulders.
Yeah, that must have been a wonderful day. In June of 1976, the following season, you and Jim Gideon and Bill Singer, it turns out, and Roy Smalley were all involved in a big trade where Texas sent you to Minnesota for Bert Blyleven and Danny Thompson. What did you think of the trade at the time?
I was delighted. I really wasn't getting much of a chance to play. Billy Martin had gotten fired. Billy gave me a little bit of a chance to play in Texas, and Billy got fired and ended up with the Yankees, and Frank Lucchesi had taken over, and I had fallen out of favor and really wasn't playing much. So I welcomed the opportunity. I was thrilled to go somewhere where I was going to get a chance to play.
Okay. And, you know, Minnesota was struggling back then, and so it was, you certainly got that opportunity. In 1978, you hit for the cycle against the Blue Jays. What do you remember about that game?
Well, I remember just about everything. I remember all 4 hits. I think Jim Clancy was a starting pitcher, right-handed, pretty good right-handed pitcher with the Toronto Blue Jays. And I think the first at bat, I had the double, but I was trying to stretch it into a triple and was thrown out. So it went in the books as a double. And the second time up, I believe I hit the home run off Clancy down the right field line. We had a lead, and they'd gone to a left-handed pitcher later in the game. I think I did this in 4 at-bats. You'd have to check it, but I believe it was Jerry Garvin, who was one of the left-handed relievers, was on the mound, and I stayed in the game because with the lead, being a platoon player up there, I didn't get pinch hit for, and I got the single off of Garvin's body, and he was still in there my last at-bat, and I got the triple off him, and I didn't realize what I'd done. I'd slid into third base, and I think Carl Kiel was the third base coach, and he came over and shook my hand, patted me on the back, and I looked up on the scoreboard, and they put it up there, and I just hit for the cycle.
It's really a rare feat.
It really is. It's one of the rarest things in baseball. I know every time somebody does it, it seems to be happen a little more often today than it did years ago, but it always was everyone that had done it, and so my name pops back up there, and it's a small club. I'm proud to be a member of it.
Yeah.
I know Jeff Bagwell did it when I was coaching down in Houston, and he didn't think it was all that big a deal. He said instead of going double, triple, he wish he'd hit 3 home runs in a game. That was just Bagwell for you.
And Jeff, he was a pretty good ball player and probably be in the Hall of Fame here pretty soon.
I wouldn't be surprised.
You ended up spending 5 years in a Twins uniform and probably had more playing time with the Twins than you did at any other time in your career. Can you tell us about your career as a Minnesota Twin between 76 and 80 and you know, how you enjoyed playing there?
Well, it was the best years of my career on the field as a player. And it was where I got my opportunity, and I thank Calvin and Howard Fox and the people that ran that club. But most of the thanks go to Gene Mock, who gave me my chance to play. And And Gene made me feel good about myself as a major league player. And I learned a great deal of baseball from Gene Mock. And the things I remember is we really had great offensive clubs where we could mash. And it was just fun to be a part of those lineups. I was pretty much a platoon player. In my best years, I'd get 400 and some at bats. Never got the chance to play every day, but there were always a lot of opportunities. There were always RBI opportunities. I hit 4 grand slams, I think, with the one of them with the Rangers. But it seems to me I got a chance to hit with the bases drunk a lot over there. And we had some really good clubs. We were competitive. We didn't win. We were in the hunt a few times, but Kansas City in our division was really good in those days, and then the White Sox got good, I think, towards the end of my stay over there with the Twins. But those were good years.
And you said, you know, Gene Mock is kind of an interesting, was an interesting manager, because from a fan's perspective like myself, he seemed to be really standoffish, and, you know, I don't know, he just didn't seem real friendly.
Well, yeah, I know that's been written about him, but the way I describe him, he was the sharpest knife in the drawer. I mean, of all the guys, and I've been in the game a long time and was in uniform on the field for 30-something years, and Gene Mock, without a doubt, was the smartest man in uniform I've ever met. Hmm. He was sharp. He was a sharp cookie.
Okay.
And there were things that I heard him say and things I watched him do and the way he prepared. And more than anything else, I think he was a master psychologist. He used to say things that really went right over my head until later on when I was coaching and managing. And I can think back and say, well, I remember when Gene said that, and how astute and how profound it was at the time. And there were things that I said to my players that I'd gotten from Gene Mock. And, yeah, I know he had that standoffish. He was, I don't know how you describe it, but I thought he didn't get fair press at times in his career, probably because of what happened in Philly and what happened in the Angels, where it just broke my heart to watch him in that series against Boston, because I was so pulling for him. But he was a great baseball man. For my money, he should be in the Hall of Fame, and the guy I got traded for in 1975 should be there too, Bert Blylevin.
Yeah, I think everybody's pulling for Bert, and I don't know what's keeping him out. I really don't. I don't know if it's just his personality or what, but, you know, hopefully next year.
Yeah, he's getting closer. He was real close this year, and I'm pulling for it. It'd be nice to say, well, I was traded for a Hall of Famer, so good luck, Bert. He'll get in eventually. But it's long overdue.
After the 1980 season, you left Minnesota as a free agent and signed with the Mets. Can you share with us what your thinking was with that move?
Well, it's just the way the system worked. I had my 6 years time in, and I really wanted to stay in Minnesota, but they didn't show a great deal of interest. They kept saying, well, we're interested, but nothing concrete or firm
sure.
placed on the table. I had an agent back in those days. I was also, I think, drafted by Seattle, Baltimore, Milwaukee, maybe the White Sox, and the only National League club were the New York Mets. And they were looking for a little help at third base. They had a rookie by the name of Huey Brooks. They weren't sure if he was quite ready to be an everyday guy. Well, as it turned out, he was, and had a really strong rookie campaign. So they made me the best offer of the bunch, and really the only solid offer I had, so I ended up going with the Mets. Frank Cashin was a general manager in those days, and he became a pretty big fan of mine.
Okay.
And I became pretty much a pinch hitter over there. Didn't get a real opportunity to play much, and that was a strike season. I think Joe Torre was the manager. I know for sure Joe Torre was the manager, of course.
Yeah.
And Joe ran me out there quite a bit as a pinch hitter. I think I led the National League in pinch hits.
Well, I think think you either hold the Mets pinch hitting record, or you're one of the top ones.
Well, I don't know about that. That's the only season I had with the Mets. I know my last at bat in the major leagues was a pinch hit home run off Jeff Weirden at Shea Stadium.
Is that right?
The last Saturday of the season, and So I went out like Williams, because Williams knew it was his last at bat. And I did, and I still thought I had a couple more years left in me, but it turned out I didn't have any.
Yeah. The Mets ended up releasing you in April of 82, and you spent, I think, the rest of the year in AAA Tidewater. And you retired after that season at the age of 32. Was it injuries that took their toll, or what?
Yeah, I had injured my back in Minnesota, and it did slow me down a little bit. It was bothering me some. I probably could have kept going. I had chances to stay in the game and play AAA, and with always that chance of getting back to the major leagues here and there. But I also had the chance to go out and manage. And when they offered me that opportunity, I decided to go try my hand at managing, and quickly found out that I enjoyed it and was ready to move on.
Okay. I believe I read somewhere that you're a diabetic, Mike. Were you a diabetic when you were playing? And if so, what kind of challenges did that pose for you as a player?
No, John, I wasn't diabetic when I played. I became a diabetic at age 38 in 1988, and it was what they call adult onset type 1, insulin dependent. And it was a real shock, a real lifestyle changer. And I was AAA manager at the time, so I managed the AAA again at Tidewater with the Mets in 1989, and then my entire major league coaching career, which is 14 straight years, I was on the lines as a type 1 diabetic. And for the first 10 years of that, I was taking shots, 3 or 4 shots a day to control the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to an insulin pump, I believe in 2000. And wish I'd done that earlier, but I was a little conscious about wearing the pump on the field. But it's a great thing, and like I said, I wish I'd gone to it years earlier, and I've worn it the last 10 years, and I'm real happy with it.
Okay. It definitely does change your life.
It really does. It's a disease. It's manageable, but you go see a doctor 2 or 3 times a year, but pretty much you become your own doctor. With diabetes, you learn to control the disease yourself and check your blood sugars and watch your insulin intake and watch your carb intake and do all that stuff and try to get your exercise. And so you become your own doctor to try to manage that disease. And I've done a pretty good job of it. I've been a diabetic for 22 years now, and knock on wood, I haven't started to have any of the major complications you can get with the disease if it goes out of control.
Yeah, it's... My brother had it, and he was overweight, and he didn't take care of himself very well, and he ended up passing away a couple years ago, you know, primarily because of that, but it's something you really have to watch, that's for sure.
He may have been a type 2 diabetic, got it at a later age, and...
Yeah, I think he was.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something. I've worked with people that were diabetics, and that they really have to keep an eye on it. You know, you can, so many bad things can happen to you.
Yeah, for sure.
Was there a player that you managed that you thought would be a great major leaguer at some point, but he never made it? And why didn't that player make it?
No one really comes to mind. I can't think of anybody that I managed that I thought was going to be a great player. I managed some guys I thought were definitely going to be major league players, and yes, they did. And I managed guys that I thought had a chance to be good major league players, and sure enough, they went on. And Rick Aguilera, for instance, said, he played for me his first year in Little Falls, and you could tell he was going to be a good player. The next year in Lynchburg, he really took off and became an all-star and got on a fast track to the major leagues. And of course, I was managing at Tidewater Club at the time we made the deal for Frank Viola with the Twins,
mm-hmm.
and sent 5 guys over there for Frankie V, and 4 of those guys were on my AAA club. And I think Aguilera was the only guy that was in the big leagues in Tappany, and David West, David West might be a name you could throw in there. I thought David West was going to be a better major league player than he ever became. I mean, he had a career and But at one time, we all thought he was going to be quite the left-handed pitcher.
Everybody seemed to be predicting big things for David West, and he just never came to pass for some reason.
Well, he had a great breaking ball when he was a kid with the Mets, and I don't know, you can always find a reason what happens, injuries or work habits or whatever. It's always something there, and I'm not sure what it was with David. I liked him. He was a great guy, and he bounced back later with the Phillies, and I pitched out of that bullpen when I was coaching in New York, so I saw some of David West. But I think when the Twins got him, they had bigger things in mind. And probably just like Carlos Gomez a couple of years ago, when they traded for Carlos Gomez, he's a guy I scouted in the minor leagues the last few years when he was with the Mets. Or not the last 2 years, because he's been in Minnesota. But I think that he has quite a ceiling, but hadn't quite figured it out yet, and who knows whether it will or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In 1990, you joined the Mets, where you served as a first base coach, and then in 1991, you were the Mets' third base coach, a hitting coach, and finally the interim manager at the end of the season when Bud Harrelson was let go. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I'd spent 7 years as a minor league manager with the Mets and had really good teams and had some winning teams. I think we were won a couple of league championships, and I don't think I had a losing record, and really had some great players and guys who went on to play in the big leagues. And so getting to be a coach up there was just the next step, and that happened in 1990, and Frank Cashin brought me up there. Davey Johnson was still the manager, but the team was starting to slide. I mean, they won the World Series in 86 and had been in the playoffs against the Dodgers in 88, I think, and were favored and were upset. And some of those stars were starting to age a little bit, and the team was going downhill somewhat. And, Davey got fired midway through that season. Bud Harrelson was named manager, and Bud, with that same aging team, the next year struggled, and he got let go the last week of the season. I remember Frank Cashin calling me at home on Long Island where I lived that summer with the Mets, and Sunday morning, the last home game of the season with a week left in the baseball season, and said he was going to let Buddy go, and wanted me to take the club over the last week of the season. And I said, sure, and just wanted to end the speculation. Sometimes the speculation gets pretty rampant at that time of year about whether the manager's coming back, and he wanted to put an end to all that so that players and managers and coaches wouldn't have to deal with it the last week of the season. Mm-hmm. So Frank Viola went out and won his 20th game that day, and I got my first win as a major league manager.
What was that like to manage in the major leagues?
Well, it was fun. I know it's a stressful job. I mean, that week was fun. And the last week of the season, when you're out of it, we were out of it, and there weren't many guys that really wanted to play. Everybody's looking forward to getting the season over. And we won that game at home on Sunday against the Phillies and went to Pittsburgh, and I think we lost two out of three there, one-run games end of the season in Philadelphia. David Cohen pitched that great game. We struck out 19, I think, on Sunday, which is the only game we won there, and lost two close games on Friday and Saturday. But it was fun. It really was, and I thought I was ready to manage in the big leagues, and at that time I thought I would manage in the big leagues, but it just didn't work out for me.
A lot of people felt that you should have been named the full-time manager at that point, but the club went with Jeff Torborg. To be honest, that must have been, I don't know how else to put it, a kind of a real kick in the gut. Can you share with us how you felt then, and what do you? Why do you think you didn't get the job?
John, it was disappointing. I know what happened was Frank Cashin retired and moved out of being general manager, just became a consultant, and he was replaced by Al Harrison. And Al didn't last very long, and he was replaced, of course, later on by Joe McElvain, who I think now works for the Twins as a scout. But I thought I was ready. I thought it was my time. But I think Fred Wilbon, one of the owners, had a good voice in that, and from what I've been told, Sandy Koufax and Fred are real good buddies. They were high school teammates. And someone said Koufax recommended Tolbert, who had been a catcher of his out in L.A. and caught a couple of his no-hitters. But Jeff had a couple of successful years in Chicago with the White Sox and managed the Cleveland Indians and had coached in New York with the Yankees. So they hired Jeff. It didn't work out. He got a four-year deal and lasted a little over a year.
Yeah.
And so the team was a little overrated. You know, once again, we've gone out and signed some guys, Bonilla and Sager Hagen and Vince Coleman. They brought some free agents in. It just didn't work out. Eddie Murray came in, aging player. So the team wasn't as good as the front office thought it was. And those years in New York, for the most part, were tough years because New York's a great place to work and play, but only if you're winning. If the team's not real good, it can be pure hell.
It's a tough place to be, that's for sure. You ended up staying with the Mets as their third base coach for five more seasons. Can you tell me why you stayed with the Mets organization?
Well, I wanted to stay. And of course, I had a big league job. I didn't want to give it up. You always try to hang on. And,
sure.
And they were pretty loyal to me through it all. They didn't think enough of me to give me the job, but they recommended me. You know, I interviewed for other jobs. They recommend Mike Cummings is going to be a good big league manager, and I'd go off and interview with the Milwaukee Brewers and Seattle Mariners or a couple other clubs I interviewed with, Houston Astros. But I enjoyed working for the other guys. I mean, Tolbert was okay. Dallas Green, I spent a couple of years with Dallas. And, of course, Davian had Bud Harrelson before him. And the last guy came in was Valentine. And when he replaced Dallas Green the last month of the season, and I pretty much knew it was my time to move on. And I'd spent 7 years there as a coach. And enjoyed New York. Really did. But like I said earlier, we weren't very good. You know, we lost 100 games, I think, one of those years. And I don't know if we had a winning record in that year, in that stretch, other than the first year with Davey Johnson when we still challenged the Pirates up until late in the season. So those were tough years, and I was ready to move on. And luckily, at the end of that time with the Mets, something opened up in Houston for me.
Yeah, and you ended up going to Houston. You were the third base coach there for about five more seasons. How did you enjoy your stay there?
I loved it. It was really a fun time. I got to work for Larry Durker, and we got cut off there somehow.
Sorry. Yeah, something happened, but that's okay. You were telling us about your time in Houston.
Yeah, those were five really good years, and Larry Durker was the manager, and Jerry Hunsicker had become the general manager down there, and we'd been together with the Mets, and Durker coming out of the broadcasting booth, Jerry wanted to put some veteran coaches around him, just to help him out, and I got hired as the third base coach down there and became close to Larry Durker, who's a very bright guy. And, you know, we had good players, and those were good years. In the playoffs, four out of the 5 years, the 98 team won 102 games. It was probably the best team I was ever around or associated with. And we got buzzsawed in the playoffs by Kevin Brown and the Padres, but I thought that was, without a doubt, the best club and probably the club that should have won a World Series for the Houston Astros.
Okay. They had some good players.
Oh, we really did. I mean, Biggio and Bagwell most likely will be Hall of Famers, and we had Moises Alou, and we got Randy Johnson in the trade. Hunsicker got Johnson in August of that year, right at the deadline, and the big unit went 11-1 for us. After going 10-11 in Seattle, and I was thinking to myself, boy, that American League must be a really tough league. But the big unit was everything we needed and just propelled us into the postseason. And Kevin Brown shut us down. We didn't hit and made a few errors behind the unit and lost some close games and got in Trevor Hoffman, shut the door on some San Diego.
And, you know, you kind of mentioned the American League versus the National League, and that brings up a good question. How do you compare the American League and the National League? Do you favor one over the other?
Well, I'm an American League guy now. I work in Tampa Bay, and I finished up with the Red Sox, so I'm back. It's a different game. It's all offense in the American League. And, you know, they try to load your lineup with non-hitters. They sacrifice defense a little bit. They don't give outs and bunts and things like that. And it's an entirely different game over in the National League, where you got the pitcher hitting, and you might have a weak spot or two in the lineup. And to take nothing away from a guy like Roger Clemens, but I was watching that pitch for the Yankees when I was coaching in Boston my last 2 years in the field, and we rushed him up quite a bit in Boston, and maybe he was just too pumped up pitching against the Red Sox, but he went to Houston and had two just fantastic years down there. And I just think it's an easier league to pitch in, and it's more challenging for the pitchers in the American League. ERAs are about a run higher, and just more emphasis on offense in that league.
Hmm. What do you think about the DH?
Well, I mean, I DH'd a few times in my career, and it keeps certain guys on. I like the game. From a manager standpoint, I like the National League game, where there are a few more decisions have to be made. Pretty much in the American League, the big decision you have to make is with your pitching staff. And in the National League, when a pitcher is hitting, you've got the pinch hit possibilities, the double switches, and just a little more action for the manager.
Sure. After you ended up leaving Houston, you ended up going over to the Red Sox and did some coaching there. You were there for a couple of seasons. How'd you enjoy your time in Boston?
It was great. It really was. I went there because of Boston and Fenway Park and the history. I was a big Ted Williams fan, and when I got that opportunity, I just couldn't say no. Plus, I've been in the National League for 12 straight years after being mostly in the American League as a player.
Sure.
So I relished the opportunity to go back to the American League. So I jumped at the opportunity to go there. And I also wanted to be a part of the rivalry. I wanted to feel the Red Sox-Yankees, the emotion of that. And I tell you, John, I spent 2 years there, and we were in the playoffs in 2003 against the Yankees, and Aaron Boone broke my heart. But I wasn't disappointed. It was everything I thought it would be and more.
Is that right? You know, you hear about it in the press all the time, but, you know, as a fan, you never get to really experience it.
Yeah, when the Yankees and Red Sox meet, it's postseason, it's electricity in the ballpark, whether it's April, bad weather. I think every one of those games, and I want to say there are 18 both years and then 7 playoff games, so that's 40-some games that I participated in that rivalry. Some July 4th weekend at Yankee Stadium with Pedro on the mound. And every one of those games was sold out. Every one of them. And just a wild, like a Southeast Conference college football crowd. Just a lot of noise, just a lot of excitement.
To me, it doesn't seem right that the other teams don't get to play the Yankees and the Red Sox and, you know, those other teams in the other divisions any more than what we do. And the only, you know, you see the Yankees come into town once. Every couple of years, it's twice. But, you know, it's, you know, every, you know, there's, people love to hate the Yankees. And you know, it's nice to play the White Sox, I guess, because they're a rival and the Tigers. But, you know, you want to see some of the other teams more often.
Yeah, well, you could do a lot of studies and talk to a lot of people about, you know, balance, unbalanced schedule, interleague play and all that. But yeah, I don't know if the Twins would agree with you that they'd like to play the Yankees more or not. Playing the Yankees is a tough duty.
Well, I think
they are a big draw everywhere they go, and so are the Red Sox. They're a big road draw, and I was fortunate that the Mets were a big road draw too. And those years, we weren't very good, but we still had Let's Go Mets chance everywhere we went.
Yeah. It's I think part of the problem that the Twins do so poorly against the Yankees now is they just don't see them enough and don't play them enough, and I think they just intimidate them. I don't know. You know, it just they're going to get over that eventually, I hope. But you know, it's certainly a big stumbling block in the Twins' attempt to move on in the playoffs at any point.
Yeah, they don't like finishing second, the Yankees.
Yeah. You ended up leaving Boston after a couple seasons, and I don't know what the circumstances were exactly there, or if you want to elaborate on that.
Well, John, my last game was Game 7 of the 2003 AL Championship of the American League Championship Series. Aaron Boone home run off Tim Wakefield. That was, I took baseball uniform off at Yankee Stadium in the visitor's locker room that night, and it turned out that was my last game in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know it. And of course, Grady Little was the manager, and with the fallout from that game,
yep,
not reaching the World Series. And I really thought, you know, I was really thinking that game, that seventh inning, I was telling myself, standing there in the third base coach's box at Yankee Stadium, and, you know, boy, you're going to the World Series. And really was excited about that, of course, and then it didn't happen. But I was hoping to go back to Boston, and I was told by, Lucchino and Phil Epstein that they wanted me back, and it just took a long time. They changed managers. They were late hiring Francona, and they came right down to it. He made the decision to go with someone else, and I got let go really late.
Mm-hmm.
And normally coaches are let go in October or right at the end of the
season.
I got notice in January. So
kind of makes it tough to find a job.
It really put a bad taste in my mouth after a really good 2-year experience there.
What was more fun for you, Mike, playing or coaching and managing?
Well, playing was more fun. I mean, it was tougher. I mean, it's a hard game at that level to play, and, especially with my skill set. But I'm obviously a better coach than a player. I coached twice as long as I played. Managing was a lot of fun, and it's also at that level very stressful. And I was with a lot of guys that I saw their hair turn gray overnight in that manager's seat. And to say the truth, John, I still have my hair color. I'm not the gray-haired guy yet that Grady Little and Sammy Palazzo and Pete McGann and a lot of guys I know that became big league managers, and within a month their hair was totally gray.
Yeah. You were major league third base coach for many years, and that is a tough role. What made you such a great third base coach? Because, you know, there aren't that many that I think are really, really good.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I was that or not. I used to be my toughest critic, and most years at the end of the season, I can look back and evaluate my season. And for the most part, I always thought I did a pretty good job personally. And others did too. I mean, Grady Little was really a big fan of mine. It's coaching in Fenway Park is not easy. It's one of the toughest places to coach.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him telling me that he'd been there as a coach under Jimmy Williams, and so he thought I was the best guy he'd ever seen dealing with the clubs and everything that pops up in that ballpark. But I had 10 years experience by the time I got there, and that certainly helped. But I don't know, I wasn't limited in any way. As a player, I had some limitations from the skill set, but as a coach, I prepared like I always prepared, so that wasn't hard to do, and I did my homework, and I'm a pretty quick learner on the fly, so I guess that's why I was a better coach than a player.
Okay. What do you remember most about your time as a Minnesota Twin?
Well, teammates, and I regret I haven't kept up with many of them. I see a few guys that are still in baseball, but just thinking back, playing with Tony Oliva, didn't play with Kilbrew. Kilbrew had gone to Kansas City, played against him in Kansas City, but getting to know Harmon a little bit when he was doing some TV. Getting to know Herb Carneal, one of the great guys, one of the great announcers that I just loved, and up until, a few years ago in his passing, I used to listen to him on XM Satellite Radio riding around in the car.
He was great.
Yeah, he was a classic. Not many guys like that around. But, you know, playing with Rodney, the great year Rodney had in 1977, where you know, he chased 400 and was MVP, and, you know, playing some with Lyman Bostock. And with Larry Heisel. Larry Heisel was one of the best teammates I ever had. What an underrated player he was, and a great guy. And, yeah, going up there with Smalley and playing side by side with him and Bobby Randall, Rob Wilfong, Bruce Weininger, just a bunch of guys that you know, enjoyed playing with.
Yeah.
Jonathan, Billy Campbell, it's an endless list, really. Yeah, we had some good players.
Yeah, that's for sure. When you look at today's players, Mike, as compared to the players that you played with, what's the biggest difference you see?
Well, these guys are. Today, there's so the personal trainers involved, and they're in such great shape. They come to spring training after spending 2 or 3 months with a personal trainer, so they're ready to go. And back in the old days, when I played, and in days before me, I think guys came to spring training to get in shape. And that's basically, you don't do that anymore. If you show up out of shape, and very few guys do, you're really going to be signaled out. You're going to stand out like a sore thumb because they expect you to be in shape and get after it from the get-go. And I think it's just the amount of money that's being paid today affords these guys the luxury of being able to do that, whereas back in my time and before my time, guys had to work off-season jobs. We had to play winter ball to supplement our income. And we didn't have time to spend 4 or 5 hours a day in the gym.
Yep.
Plus the money to pay somebody to do that. But it's just a pocket change to today's players and today's baseball world.
Yeah, you kind of see that, when I go out to the ballpark, spring training hasn't officially opened, and, you know, you see a bunch of players out there that are all out there working out and, you know, getting ready, even, after they've worked out or did whatever winter program they had since November or December.
Yeah, they've got programs. It's all tailored and structured, and strength coaches and hitting coaches and the video and the access to the ways you can study and so forth. It's just so much more technology in the game today that's player friendly. And I think if players use the technology and the advanced things that are there from trainers and weight rooms that are, have every piece of equipment known to mankind in them, and they can really help themselves become a better athlete, a better ball player.
Sure. What do you think should be done about the stats of the players that have been connected to the steroid controversy?
Well, John, that's a tough question. I really don't know how to answer that, and I think I'll let somebody else decide that. Somebody that makes a lot more money than I do. And I will say this, it's still a cloud hanging over it, and it's really ugly. Sometime down the road, some official in baseball is going to have to explain to a group of kids why all these guys with 500 plus home runs and perhaps a few with 600 plus aren't in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's not going to be easy. So, but I don't think you can take the guys that have been caught and take their home runs away from them or put an asterisk by their names because. It was an error, and there are guys out there that haven't been caught or haven't been...
Absolutely.
But no one's going to come forth and say, I'm feeling sorry now. I also took the stuff. I don't think that's going to happen. So I don't know what to do about it, but it's too bad. But it was pretty rampant, I think, in that era. And
well, did you?
All records are sacred, and I don't think anyone knows what to do with the stats now, and what all happened in that decade or decade and a half or however long it was.
Did you see any of that or suspect any of that when you were managing in the minors?
I really not in the minors. I really didn't, and I was right there in the middle of it, especially as a big league coach. It happened, when I was there, I know we marveled at the strength of Mark McGuire. I didn't see him play, but being in the National League as a coach and Mark being over in Oakland, when he came to St. Louis, I remember going out and watching him take batting practice in the Astrodome. And he did 7, 8, 10 balls a day in BP in the upper deck. Well, prior to that, you rarely saw a ball go in the upper deck. And here he's hitting them way up there. And Sosa and other guys doing the same thing, with, you know, not quite as far as what I was hitting them. So, it wasn't until probably when I got to Boston that you started to hear a little talk about it in my last few years, and then it kind of spiraled out of control shortly thereafter.
Yeah, that's, you know, to a fan, it's really a disappointment. You know, Roger Clemens was, you know, he was supposedly the guy that did all this working out, and, you know, he was, you know, the star pitcher, and then to have all that kind of come crashing down, and, of course, he didn't handle it, I don't think, all that well either, but it's, you know, just a big disappointment.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I think everybody in baseball, Bud Selig and all the officials, would probably like to wipe their hands and wish it would just go away, but I'm afraid it's not, because
it's going to be there for a while.
It's going to be there for a while, and as time goes on, there'll be more guys named. It's just going to keep the fire burning. It's going to be a hard fire to put out.
Yeah. What manager did you enjoy playing for the most, and why?
Well, Billy Martin has a special place in my heart because he gave me that first chance. He was a manager that told me, "Hey, Cubby, you're making the club. You're going north with us to Arlington, Texas." And I still remember that conversation. And he gave me my chance in with the Rangers. But the guy that I'm most fond of and definitely had the most respect for is number four, Gene Mock, without a doubt. He's heads above everybody else in my book, and he made me feel better about myself as a major league player than anyone else by far. And I knew what I was, and I was just a very mediocre, average guy. But Gene had that. He was a master psychologist, and I think I said earlier, and he had a way of making players feel good about themselves. And I think when you do that, you bring out the best in guys.
When you look back at all the players that you either played with or watched play, Mike, is there one name that stands out as a player that had so much ability, but yet he never turned out to be the superstar that everyone expected?
Well, yeah, there are probably a couple of guys, and they're both going into the New York Mets Hall of Fame this summer. And I'm talking about Strawberry and Good. We know why they didn't turn out, but they should be going into the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. That's the kind of ability they had. And they would tell you, if you were talking to them right now, that the same thing. That they changed themselves and their careers and their fans a little bit, but some of the turns their careers made. But Strawberry was a five-tool guy, and I saw him as a kid. And he had Hall of Fame written all over him. And the way Gooden burst onto the scene, and you know, his first couple of years, is the most dominating guy since probably Koufax, and they're in New York, but things got out of control, and you know, they were both good players, but not the great Hall of Fame type guys that they should have and could have been.
What kind of a person was Darryl Strawberry? I mean, was he a decent person, or was he just, you know, a lot of people make him out to be, I guess, a real jerk because of the, you know, the drugs and the drinking and whatnot?
Well, that was there. I mean, I think he's put that in the past, and I've heard people say today that he's really turned out well, so to speak. He's turned the stone, and I know some people that know him now, and after everything he's gone through, and I think he's also dealt with cancer in addition to battling the drugs, spending some time in jail, wives, losing all his money, and everything went wrong in his life, and I think today people that know him would say they're pretty proud of him. So I never had a problem with him. I think Daryl, you know, being that number one pick in the country and a big target, the guy got to New York and was going to be the, you know, the guy that led the Mets to the promised land. Great deal of pressure on him, and had a lot of people pulling at his side, wanting a piece of him.
Sure.
And as oftentimes, sometimes happens, I'm going to say oftentimes, but sometimes things get out of control, and I think it happened to both Daryl and Doc, and they took some wrong turns, and it cost them part of their career. It should have been great Hall of Fame careers and good careers, but
sometimes things end in strange ways.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I think you're scouting for the Tampa Rays nowadays. Mike, can you give us a quick scouting report on the Minnesota Twins?
I wish I could, but I'd have to turn you over to Gene Glenn. He's our Rays scout up there that has the Twins and lives in Minnesota. And I don't really get to see him very often except for on TV. And I could give you a report on the Washington Nationals or the Phillies. Some of my major league clubs, but I tell you, the scouting community, the Twins have a great deal of respect for our baseball, and not only their amateur guys, but the pro guys, and I know a lot of them, and, you know, Terry Lyons over there, Neil from the Mets, and Joe McElvain's over there, and they just do a great job, and last year I was out in Beloit, Wisconsin, never been there before, and watching the Cedar Rapids play, so scouting some guys with the Angels on that Cedar Rapids club, and walked into the ballpark, and there's that Terry Ryan and Billy Smith and Tom Kelly and Jim Rance. So I had a great time spending a couple of days with those guys. They were out watching their club play there, and they do a good job in scouting and player development over there in Minnesota and have for years.
Great. From a scout's perspective, how do you describe Mike Cubbage as the ball player?
Well, I'm pretty hard. I'm a tough grader when it comes to that. I wouldn't be all that kind, but you know, I'd say, you know, a heady ball player, intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
Probably dead low fastball hitter. Quick bat, handsy swing, some pull power, probably enough power to get it. Get himself in trouble. Not real good raw power, but a little pull power. Arm short. Hands a little below average. Not a good runner, but a decent, intelligent base runner. Probably a second division guy. If he's going to play a lot and if he's going to be on a foot running club, it's probably going to be as a role player.
Okay.
Batty's best tool.
Okay. What, Mike, today, what do you enjoy doing most in your spare time?
Well, this winter I've been doing too much snow shoveling in my spare time. Way too much. And I don't enjoy that.
No, that's not much fun.
I live on a golf course in Virginia, and I don't get to play as much as I like. Guys at the club tease me about playing four or five rounds a year here, and that's all it's been the last couple of years. And they start doing the math, and they say, "Whoa, what are you paying per round?" And I don't even like to think about it because it does come out to pretty expensive rounds of golf when you take in the monthly dues. But I tell you the truth, what I enjoy doing in my free time now is spending time with my grandkids. I've got two of them, Connor and Maddie. Connor's five, a left-handed hitter, and Maddie will be three in May. And they live in McLean, Virginia, about 2 hours from us here in Charlottesville, Keswick. And that's what I really enjoy is getting to spend time with them.
And that's a great thing. It's too bad they live that far away from you.
Well, yeah, at times it's a good thing,
and
other times it's not.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, I respect the parents a great deal, they all have a lot of energy, and they've done a really good job with them. They're two bright, young, sharp kids, but they're also
well, Mike,
a handful. I know we haven't played for a weekend. We're usually pretty exhausted by the end of the weekend.
Yeah, they wear you out. No question about that. Well, Mike, I thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate the opportunity to spend this time speaking with you and talking about your career.
You bet.